From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made the last time you wanted a drink on a Tuesday night. Did you grab a beer on the way home? Did you text a friend asking to meet for cocktails? Did you go out to one of the new and burgeoning Rochester breweries? Did you think about grabbing a bottle of wine, maybe? A new report finds it probably was not the latter. According to the Silicon Valley Bank's annual State of the Wine Industry report, wine is in trouble, and here's the reason. The report says that for too long, the industry has relied on millennial consumers to simply step in and take over the consumption habits of their parents and grandparents. And that hasn't happened. Report author Rob McMillan says the wine industry has reached a tipping point now. Wine isn't all that cool, and with the advent of cannabis, it's suffering even more. McMillan explains that the industry had negative growth recently, and that hasn't happened since 1993. In a rather an understatement, he says that's a big deal. And here are some more of the stats from the report highlighted recently by wine journalist Joe Roberts. From 2015 to 2018, the U.S. wine biz lost 4 million drinkers during a time when the country became the number one wine market globally and the number of adults of legal drinking age increased. And sales for three of the largest wine producers in the United States are all down. Roberts recently wrote that it might be too late for the U.S. wine industry to stop this trend. He added, quote, "If you're taken by surprise that younger drinkers are eschewing wine for cannabis, beer, cocktails, and even spiked seltzer, then you are a fool," end quote. Well, this hour we try to understand what's happening with wine, and in particular, we'll explore the impact on the Finger Lakes wine industry, and we'll also try to understand whether wine has a chance to get back into the cultural good graces for young adult consumers. Our guests include the guy who stirred the pot in the first place. Joe Roberts is a journalist and author of the One Wine Dude website, and I confess a longtime friend. Hi, Joe. How are you?
Hey, Evan. I'm doing great. How are you?
Very good. It's nice to have you on the line with us, and we got a couple of guests in studio with us. The best blind taster I know is Bob Medill, the wine director for Kindred Fair and a wine industry liaison for the Finger Lakes Wine Alliance. It's nice to have you in studio.
Nice to be here, Evan. Thanks very much.
It's great to have August Dymel as well. August is winemaker for Cuca Spring Vineyards, and nice to see you in studio. I'm usually on the phone with you.
Yes, indeed. It's good to be here.
Well, I want to start by asking Joe why you were writing that, in a sense, it's fair to ask if it's too late here, that you've been warning for years that the wine industry was not paying enough, either not paying enough attention or not doing the right things to make sure that when young people became young, you know, sort of adults of age, that they would be interested in wine. Do you think it's too late?
I think it's too late in the context of preventative medicine. So it's been, I don't know, about 10 years since I've been standing on my soapbox and screaming about this kind of thing and urging wine brands to start to move at least a percentage of their marketing budgets into looking into how younger consumers approach wine and changing their approaches versus, say, cash cows like the baby boomers buying wine who respond to those marketing trends a bit differently. And I think what I mean by the preventive medicine piece is over now, in that wine industry's sick. You know, I mean, they've got an illness, right? We have data now that support the fact that younger consumers are bleeding away from wine in favor of other types of beverages, and you know, including even things like coffee. And so now it's time to maybe staunch the bleeding and try and recover and gain some healthiness.
Bob Medill, agree with Joe there?
Well, not exactly, but in sort of the general sense of the strategy of the industry writ large, yes, I do. And the interesting aspect of what you're saying here, Joe, and incidentally, thank you very much for raising this, because I took the opportunity to read around and become better versed in millennial behavior. Really opened my eyes quite a bit. So I think your writing here has helped to bring some focus to a critical strategic issue, because I think you're right. Writ large in brand terms, yes, I agree with you completely. And in my own observations locally, I think your salient point about the business model here relying mostly on the tasting room and less on trying to understand how to interact or otherwise engage with consumers that, such as millennials, has been left alone quite a bit.
But when you say you don't entirely agree, elaborate a little bit more there.
Sure. I don't think the Finger Lakes, we're not in a position where we really have the notion of a brand established here in the Finger Lakes. I mean, if I think of one of the, even any of the big wineries, in the context that Joe would be using the word brand, We don't even come close. I mean, one arguably could think of maybe the Finger Lakes itself being a bit of a brand, a regional brand, but not a Glenora or a Swedish Hill. So that being the case, and given the fact that for the most part, the Finger Lakes is basically working its way into that paradise of the American market that Joe was quite correct in his article saying it's one of the biggest of this, the biggest one in the world. We still have a ton of opportunity because we're basically pioneering our way into that.
Okay. August Dymel, agree or disagree with Joe Roberts, first and foremost?
So winemakers have a certain occupational hazard, and this particular hazard is being jealous of brewers. We are all jealous of brewers. And the reason that we are all jealous of brewers takes on many, many forms. And one of them, of course, is that they get to make brew beer every day, and we get to make wine once a year. But one of the things that, but the thing that's relevant to this conversation is that breweries feel far more free in their marketing than wineries do.
Why?
I don't know. Because we are somehow stuck in old models. We are somehow unable to adapt. You walk through the beer section of Wegmans, and it is a cornucopia of different formats, of different marketing styles, of different, of different everything, different names, much more fun, much more exciting. You walk through any wine store, and the only things that are fun and different are the things we all make fun of. And so for whatever reason, wine is unable to...
Are you talking about the labels? What are you talking about?
I'm talking about everything. I'm talking about the labels. I'm talking about the fact that almost all wine is sold in 750 milliliter glass bottles. So there's packaging. There's even just the way that we talk about wine. You know, wine has from a time long ago, far away, that predates all of us, had a notion of snootiness and sort of ranking of wines. You have better wines and worse wines. And then you have the marketing angle of you either buy into that, like, yes, we are the great wine, we are the 99-point wine, or you have, we don't buy into that snobbery, we are against that snobbery, but it is all sort of in the same general world of marketing. And
but human beings rank everything. We rank TV shows, we rank beers too.
We do rank beers, but it's not nearly as important.
Okay.
Like, you are not walking through Wegmans and seeing shelf talkers that are like 93 points, 92 points.
It is true that I've never gone out for a beer saying, or with anybody who said, well, I want to make sure I get a 90-point beer.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Right.
And I think that that's a problem for wine, that we are set in these particular mindsets, and that the way we're evaluating wine isn't so much as do we like it, do we not like it. We're evaluating wine on some faux scale that doesn't really exist of like better and worse in a way that's, I think it's an unhealthy obsession with evaluation. That beer, it's easy for me to just go and buy a beer and it's like, is it good? Is it not? I don't really care. Like, I like it, whatevs.
Okay, so Joe Roberts, I want to kick it back to Joe, and then I'll tell our listeners, we're not just here to bury wine. I mean, we did not just come for the purpose. The good news is everybody on this program is excited about wine, and we wouldn't be talking about this. And certainly we have an industry in the Finger Lakes that, still blows me away to this day. And I started writing a book more than 10 years ago. I'm amazed with it. Bob Medill, by the way, I not only quoted in that book, but also I distinctly remember when you talked about what we ought to be emphasizing in our identity, you did this in the staccato, this fire of aromatic white wine. Aromatic white wine.
Yep.
And, if in Iowa and Washington State and everywhere you go, if they knew that's what the Finger Lakes was, maybe that identity, we could have dominated that. I don't know. But we'll get back to that point because I still remember Bob saying that. Maybe 11 years later, he's still saying that. Joe, on the subject of ranking and rating wines, to August's point, has that hurt the industry in a way that beer is more free?
Well, I think he's spot on in that analysis. I think Two things there. I mean, one is in beer, there's rarely any ivory tower pronouncements, right, that that affect our consumption, right? You guys have pointed that out. In wine, it's the exact opposite. And for decades, we have had that model. The wine world more or less embraced it. In fact, you know, I think to the point where they're, generally speaking, they're quite happy to offload the responsibility of telling their own sort of personal human stories and the things that make them unique, the things that will get you interested in a brand and sell it. They've offloaded that power. And what's interesting is that that's not how typically how younger consumers are showing that they want to respond to brands. They want to connect more personally and kind of expect it, actually. Now, having said that, I'm 47 years old, so I'm speaking about younger consumers and millennials, not for them. But I think that those ivory tower pronouncements in general, since they resonated with boomers, the wine business writ large ran with that. And instead of fine tuning then how they might expect younger generations to react differently to that those consumables, they just didn't do much of anything. And that, I find, is strange because I can't think of any other service or consumption where, generally in the luxury space at least, where we expect to just sort of change over time and do things the same way our parents or grandparents did. I mean, nobody does that. I didn't stop loving prog metal music because my mom likes Ricky Nelson. Now, I'm okay listening to Ricky Nelson, it's cool, but that's not what tugs at my heartstrings every day in terms of listening to music. And that's never going to change. The nostalgia business brings in billions of dollars across multiple different industries every year. And that wouldn't be the case if people didn't hang on to the things that they love from their formative years. So the styles of wines that younger consumers want, they're a bit different. The price they're willing to pay, that's a bit different. The way they want to interact with the brands, that's a bit different. But we just, the wine business, for whatever reasons, just haven't made those pivot points. So I think some of those scores and reviews certainly can help because people, I think, still want to know that they're not throwing away $25, $15 on a product. But having said that, the way that those scores are presented in that sort of this is what you should be liking format, that is not working.
All right. So before we get to Teta on the phone, who has some interesting ideas on cultural and historical perspectives on this, let me ask our guest to respond. And Joe, in his piece that we can link to for you on the line with us, is Joe Roberts, who's a wine journalist and the author of the One Wine Dude blog. Joe wrote in his piece, quote, "From where I sit, the majority of people within all tiers of the wine business either think that what works in selling wine to one generation, baby boomers, works for all subsequent generations, or simply don't care, or don't want to use any time, tools, or effort to change. In any of those cases, they are predictably wrong." That's an extension of what you just heard from Joe. Bob Medill, fair or unfair?
Fair. Yeah, I think that's true. I think the industry is somewhat traditional, hidebound a little bit, you could say. I'm encouraged by the fact that in the Finger Lakes, at least, we're undergoing some of the more classic firms with the next generation coming in. And sometimes it's the third generation, but younger, definitely younger people, definitely more flexibility, different mindset completely, a little bit more animated, I would say, just in their general demeanor. One thing I wanted to ask you, Joe, and I'm just mulling this proposition over in my mind that as an emerging wine region in the U.S. market, for the all intents and purposes, do you think that our regions, such as the Finger Lakes, and you might say Virginia, for example, as well, do you think we have an opportunity which is slightly different or less challenged in the issues that you bring forward?
I do, actually. I think there are some challenges in that production volumes are low. And in that case, that means a lot of times consumers have to come to you, which I think Rob McMillan, who wrote that Silicon Valley Bank report that Evan talked about in the intro there, you know, he had said, "What, you know, you don't go to Detroit to buy a car, right? So, I mean, there is a challenge there. Having said that, these wines that are being made in the Finger Lakes have never been better. The quality level is stellar now, and there are markers, particularly to the best Rieslings in the area, that really speak to the place. There are lots of small producers who have great humanist stories. Evan wrote a book about a lot of those, and they're fascinating. And those things are all great ways to connect with younger consumers. Those are really nice things to have under their hats. So in some ways, I think they being smaller and having the more humanistic connection and something that's a bit more place-driven in terms of the product, I think all those things are strengths.
Okay. August, do you want to jump in too on as we look at generations? And
yeah, I mean, well, a couple of things. One is, you know, we know that right now boomers still make up a huge percentage of the sales that we have at the winery.
Right now. I'm emphasizing that point because how long are we talking here?
Not very long. Yeah. You know? And so, but at the same time, the question is, you know, if you're going to change over your marketing, at what point do you do it? And at what point do you risk alienating your current market base in order to move on? And I think that the wine industry has generally held on too long to what worked in the past. I'm not suggesting that we don't change over, but I am suggesting that there is a mentality that this is working for the moment, and it usually you need to, you know, you need to get kicked somewhere in order to in order to move along. So there's that. The other point that I want to make, and it's sort of, you know, playing a little off of what Bob is saying, is that the Finger Lakes right now does have the luxury of not being fully exposed to the broad trends in the wine industry. Obviously, they affect everybody, but at the same time, we have so little wine to sell that we can, you know, create a niche somewhere and occupy that niche. And even if the wine industry is trending downward overall, if we can build ourselves within that niche, we are a little bit insulated from this simply because we are so small. So I think that there is a way in which, while this affects us and long term, it's something we need to respond to, I actually expect the Finger Lakes to be slower to respond to it because we aren't quite as exposed to the broader trends as, I mean, if you own 20% of the wine business, you have to respond to every meaningful trend. And, you know, we own what percentage of the of
how many zeros would you like?
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's we are not the flea on the dog. We are the bacterium on the flea on the dog.
Well, so. And to be clear, just to kind of put a point on what size we're talking about here. Obviously, the Finger Lakes wine industry is not insignificant in this region. Right. It is a massively important multi, I don't know what the number annually, Bob Mandel probably knows more quickly than I do.
I think latest measures were it contributes something well over $10 billion to the
local economy, yeah.
To the state economy.
So with a B. So yeah. It's not small. But they are right to say that when you look at California, when you look at Washington State, when you look at even Oregon, it is much smaller. To the point where I remember being at Chateau Saint-Jean in Sonoma in 2006, and they said, we're doing 350,000 cases a year. We're mid-size. I said, mid-size?
No, it's shocking.
Mid-size. Yeah. A mid-size producer in the Finger Lakes is 12,000?
I'd say even smaller. I'd
maybe
say
10.
Eight to 10.
8 to 10,000 is mid-size here. 350,000 is mid-size on the West Coast. So there's just a little bit of a scale for you when it comes to the volume point. And maybe that insulation will be helpful to kind of withstand some of the lessons. Let me get on the phone. Our first phone call is from Teta in Rochester. Go ahead, Teta.
Hi there. Historical and cultural perspectives. I've been trying to get it trimmed down so I can make it shorter. When I was a child, somebody had me taste some Cayuga-based wine, and it was so sweet and icky. It was like candy. Now, my family is Laurent Perrier and Montmessin, and the cheapest Montmessin Burgundy retails for about $85 a bottle. And I married a man who thought Mogan David was pretty cool. So I switched over for a while to beer simply because my palate couldn't deal with Mogan David. No offense. But I would point out to you that 100 years ago, America didn't have a wine industry. We now do. Chile now has a wine industry. Mm-hmm. Australia has some very fine vintages that I go out of my way to look for. And we need to stop thinking about stratifying by age group and instead approach people in terms of connectedness, family, civilized people enjoy. Now, I'm an outsider. I'm an American citizen, but for my son's first birthday party at a large Baptist church, I rented a hall, and I had six bottles. We had 80 people coming. I had six bottles of excellent champagne, three bottles of a nice dry white, six bottles of Blue Nun, two cases of beer, and some Coca-Cola for the Yahoos, and some water for the scaredy cats. And the Baptist church informed me that they didn't allow spirituous liquor. And I remained civil because my father was a diplomat, but my first year in an American school was the United Nations school in fifth grade, and I came home shaking with indignation and rage and said, get me out of here, Daddy. It's not a secure. It's not a sanitary. They serve tap water for lunch. This was 1959. And he said, well, what did you have when you were in Monaco and Paris and Deauville and Saint-Tropez? And I said, for lunch? Wine, of course. Like, where are you coming from? And he was from upstate New York, and he sputtered his wine that he was drinking. He spattered it. It was in his mouth, and he couldn't swallow it. He was laughing so much. But in the 1950s, we had extensive bombing of sewage and water lines in France, and the sanitary thing to consume, the safe thing for a child to drink that was good for him or her, was wine. So I would suggest that if we go back to marketing, I'm not proposing we get into brewing mead. I think it's too much of a stretch. That's going back a couple thousand years. But wine and beer are ways that civilized people connect with each other with a low probability of killing people in a car accident. And if you try to say that to a Russian, I have Russian friends, they laugh at you because a real Russian doesn't bother with wine. That's for wimps. They drink vodka. So end of discussion, but thank you for allowing me an opportunity to speak. Appreciate it.
Ted, I was not ready for most of that phone call, I confess.
That was good.
That was fascinating. Yeah. No, there was this really proletarian ideal of just, let's just get wine on the lunch table, the same way they do in Europe, and demystify it and not make it this elitist thing wrapped up in this strange elitist ideal, which I think mm-hmm. is actually, I don't say that to sort of malign Ted. I think the sentiment is there to say, culturally, can we ever get this on the table? Bob Madillo, are we ever going to say wine's going to be on the table in the same way that's no big deal for a family's Tuesday night meal or a lunch in the same way that is in Europe? Is that a reasonable goal?
I think it's a reasonable goal, Evan. It depends how long you want to wait for it. I think that it's a struggle in certain parts of the country. Wine with lunch is an interesting point because if I'm out and I'm feeling at all celebratory, I'll have a glass of wine with my lunch and enjoy it immensely. It's just a habit of mine. I look around and there may be a handful of us. I know, having worked at Kindred Fair now for the better part of several years, we are attracting a cohort of younger people, probably a good many of them are millennials, and I try to inform myself about what they're drinking. And it's really true that they're drinking a lot of cocktails, but I'm still mm-hmm. seeing a lot of bottles of wine and glasses of wine, and wines by the glass are quite popular. We have friends in common, such as Stuart Pigott, who have sort of looked at the U.S. and say, well, my goodness, you're just not a cafe culture. But we can go to parts of this wonderful country that certainly has a cafe culture. New York City in the summer, you sit outside San Francisco. So there are areas where the culture of wine is well embraced and becomes a more normal part of everyday life, as the caller pointed out quite articulately.
Yeah, well, Ted, thank you. Go ahead, August.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things about that is, okay, we have 300 million people in this country. We are never going to have as broad a cultural connection to wine as Ted describes. But the question is, can we have some percentage of those 300 million people enjoy wine like that? And I think that there's a good question about whether, as a wine industry, we want to be broad or deep. In other words, do we want everybody drinking the occasional bottle of wine, or do we want to really make wine for those people like Bob, like myself, like you, I assume, Evan.
Yes, sir.
Who want to have that bottle on their on their table every night. And honestly, I think those are two very different marketing messages. And I think those will appeal to very different people. And I don't think we are ever going to have the entire country. The entire country, honestly, it's a beer drinking country. You know, you look at what's our biggest shared cultural experience on an annual basis, it's probably the Super Bowl. What do you drink at the Super Bowl? You drink beer.
And you drink beer and you watch commercials of Bud, who, what are they afraid of? Look at their Super Bowl commercials. They're afraid of beer in the craft variety. Yeah. They're making fun of people's beards. Yep. They're not afraid of wine.
Yeah.
They're literally afraid of other beers and they're trying to buy them up. Joe, what would you say to Ted's point there? And I think August is really kind of crystallizing the different paths you can take. I tend to think he's right. You're not going to get everybody in a 340 million person country. You're not going to get everybody in the same way or close to everybody that other countries can. But what strategies do you see as unused so far here, Joe?
Well, I think that in general, wine brands don't really understand their end consumers all that well. That's not all brands, but in general, they don't. And so there really is a pretty large pyramid. I mean, it's big, big money. And this is a lot of product that gets made. And generally speaking, you know, there's a large lower tier in that pyramid, and you've got folks who, you know, they're going to a big box store and their spouse calls and says, oh, don't forget the Chardonnay. You know, so they get an industrial size pack of peanut butter and then an industrial size pack of paper towels and then huge jugs of Chardonnay. And they're just not all that concerned. I mean, it's just something that they consume. And when you move up that tier, I think people are willing to usually get a little bit more involved in the price. And then you get up to sort of that tippy top of the pyramid, which is smaller, but a lot more expensive. And generally, when we talk about wine marketing, we're really talking about the top two tiers of that pyramid. But we forget sometimes that pyramid is so large. So I think there's room for all of the things that we've just discussed from that great call. And I think that that cafe culture, for example, that's part of it. You know, and you can target that middle and upper tier of wine consumer in that type of environment. I think that change is kind of well underway. It's just that the cost is still prohibitive to a lot of people.
Well, I want to get back to our phone calls from Cameron and Carl. We're coming to you after this only very short break. As we go to break, the points that our guests in studio have raised when it comes to even packaging size, August Dymel raised. CT writes to the program and says, Evan, my wife likes white semi-sweet wines. I like dry reds. Okay, now for dinner at home, we have to buy two bottles that pour four glasses, big glasses, when our doctors say only one or two drinks per what time period. So package size can be a problem for us. If we go out, she has half a carafe and I have two pints. So CT, bringing up kind of the point that August made, and you've seen some producers, even in the Finger Lakes, try different formats, different packaging styles and bottle options, but maybe that's part of the solution as well. And maybe, to the point that August was making, the stodginess, the turning up your nose at a new format because of tradition. Maybe tradition is good, but also a little limiting. Let's get that only break of the hour. We're going to come back and talk about how to move the wine industry forward to get it back into sort of the cultural zeitgeist. August Dymel is one of our guests in studio, the winemaker from Cuca Spring Vineyards on Cuca Lake. Bob Medill, the wine director for Kindred Fair and the wine industry liaison for the Finger Lakes Wine Alliance. Joe Roberts on the line with us, a journalist and author of the One Wine Dude website. Back to your phone calls next. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, Harvard Law professor Larry Lessig will be in Rochester. He joins us for a conversation on the money primary and if he thinks there's been any progress in changing the way our elections are funded. Then in our second hour, Sarah Bromero is an associate professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. We sit down with her to discuss her research on migration in Central America and the U.S. position on foreign aid toward developing nations. Welcome back. More feedback coming from our guests, from our listeners. Barb says, one reason our household has reduced the purchase of wine is that during the week, sometimes I'd like to have a glass of wine with dinner, but I do not want to open a $16 bottle of wine for one glass, knowing that I might not have another glass for 2 to 3 days because the flavor has changed. So I elect not to have any at all, and I will wait until we are entertaining people to open any bottles of wine. So again, for format and just consumption habits, something to keep in mind. Next is Cameron in Penyan. Go ahead, Cameron.
So good afternoon. I think some of the gents here on the panel know me as well, but I've been in the wine industry now for over 15 years at the wholesale level, primarily working for specialized independent wholesalers. And I can tell you through my experience that there has been consistent growth in the these aspects of the wholesale model. And though Southern Wine and Spirits, who's been in New York now for a little over 10 years, has yet to struggle to turn a profit, that there's consistent growth in the smaller brands of the wine industry. And I think that as these younger consumers become woke, just as they are in beer, they're eschewing some of the larger brands, and they're seeking to find, you know, satisfaction in supporting smaller brands of wine. And it takes a lot longer to get these brands established, but people are looking for options of people who produce wine that have a stronger connection to the place it's from producers who make wine that is more focused on their farming methods and the methods in the wineries. And I think this will take longer to percolate out, but I'm a millennial myself, and my millennial friends who are not in the industry are drinking wine. They're just making different choices about what they drink and how they drink it.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you, Cameron. Bob Medill, I'll start with you. I think all of our guests are going to want to weigh in on that. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, good points, Cameron. Good to chat with you this way. I'm just still mulling over some of the very basic elements here and trying to adjust in my own mind this element of conservatism that has been pointed out, both in packaging, the size of bottles and so forth, and as well as the lack of engagement with some of these younger people who want to be engaged in a different fashion. And I think that to me is one of the real take-home messages here is, if you're going to be successful in the future, you can't simply open up your tasting room doors and have a one-size-all experience for anybody that walks through. Similarly, we're leaving an opportunity on the table by failing to find the right tools in which to engage socially and with e-commerce, so that the person who wants to buy that bottle of Riesling, or because I think the values that most of the wineries represent here in the Finger Lakes have a resonance with the millennial consumer. Authentic farming methods, just the whole small cultural aspect of it here. And so I think we have that opportunity, and we're as yet not engaging as we should or can as an industry, as a Finger Lakes industry.
Okay, August?
Wow, a lot of things, a lot of feelings on that one. So number one is, yes, I do think that there is something to be said for younger consumers really engaging with these small brands and loving these small brands. I think that is true. But I think a lot of us are frankly using the same marketing models and using the same mentalities. And I think that we would do a lot better if we were dividing up this market, dividing and conquering in some sense. I feel like we're all chasing after the same placements in restaurants. We're all chasing after the same scores. We're all chasing after the same sort of validation from the gatekeepers in the industry. And I think that's less true than it used to be. It used to be that you got a score from Parker and that was that. But I think that we are still chasing after a lot of the same stuff, which means that these smaller brands are actually cannibalizing each other as opposed to growing the industry more broadly. I think if we tried to figure out a way for each of these smaller brands to be reaching a different type of consumer, whether that's a different age cohort, whether that is some that frankly would be marketing maybe to different consumers in terms of gender, in terms of sexual orientation, in terms of a lot of different things, you know, I think that there's a lot of communities who don't feel welcomed into the wine world. I think that it is still, let's be clear, we have four men over the age of 35, four white men over the age of 35 having this conversation right now. And I think that that's not accidental. So I think that if some of these smaller brands took a chance in their marketing and tried to grow the wine industry by bringing new people into the fold, I think we'd be a lot more successful. That said, and my apologies to Cameron, who is working for, you know, smaller and mid-sized distributors, those are going away. And there's been such a and I realize this is super inside baseball, but it matters for consumers out there because it determines what wines get to your shelves. It is very hard for a small winery to be distributed far from its home because a lot of the small and mid-sized distributors who used to champion small wineries are going away, and that makes it very hard to get some of these smaller, cooler brands in front of people. And I think that that means that the people who are determining where the industry is going tends to be the larger companies.
So one quick point for you before I turn to Joe Roberts,
sure,
for his thoughts on this. So is the logical next idea in this frame that if wine is for wealthy white people, you're in real trouble as an industry?
Oh, yeah.
And the notion that that wine is not accessible, that is not affordable, that it is not for everybody is reflected in different ways, whether it's the big glossy publications, whether it's the scores, whether it's the huge prices on the bottles, whether it's who works in the industry and who is marketed to, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. And I will just very quickly say, so I had a family member of mine subscribe to Wine Spectator because she wanted to understand what I did for a living and have some conversantness in this world. And she dropped her subscription because she's like, this is speaking to a very different group of people than I belong to. And she felt very cut out. And Spectator is, this is not to dump on Spectator, but they are the leading publication out there. And the fact is, it's speaking to a pretty narrow audience, and I think that that's a problem.
Okay, so, but Joe Roberts, given your analysis of this, is that uniquely true for wine in a way that beer or cocktails does not have that problem?
Well, I think in some ways, beer and cocktails do have an interesting leg up on wine. So generally speaking, they are not as price prohibitive, right, to try out. Cocktails don't usually have the same distribution problems, right? Some case craft beer, but a lot of cases small production wine have. In wine, we have a very odd scenario in the U.S. in that it has never been easier for a brand. Let's, for sake of argument, take small independent brands like there are in the Finger Lakes. It's never been easier for those brands to reach out directly to and find the consumers that want their products. And that can be done online, for example, for very little cost. In some cases, no cost outside of the time that it takes to do it. Now, it's not easy work. It's in a lot of ways, it's taking the same corner store mentality or tasting room experience mentality and then stretching that out over a virtual connection to someone. But a lot of these small brands have the skill set to do it well. The part that's maddening is that we've got an odd three-tier, overly regulated system in terms of alcohol movement throughout this country and sales of it. And so, by finding those consumers, you hit the frustration point many times of not being able to actually get the product in their hands. That is a shame, and I think we are starting to see more efforts legally on getting direct-to-consumer sales more in line with, you know, I think where we ought to be from a time scale. You know, the laws are a little too anachronistic at the moment. And we're starting to see movement there. It's promising, but that's a big impediment. And I think it's a not insubstantial contributor to, you know, what we're seeing with millennial consumers. It's just yet another piece of a frustration point for people, right? So you've got something that you may find that you want, but then in most ways it's not presented in a way with which you identify, and even if it is, you may not be able to actually get the stuff at a store or to your door.
Well, let's get more of the feedback from our audience, and I'll get to your phone calls. Art, I'll take you in just a second. Michael writes to us and says, I don't understand why Finger Lakes wine is so underrated. I think that Finger Lakes red wine is as good as any I have ever had. Yes, Michael, I'm sure
Thank you, Michael.
Bob, thanks, Mike.
Bob and August, don't even know him, I promise. That wasn't a planted email. And the part of the point, Michael, part of the point is that the wine industry is in trouble sort of writ large because of the fact that the new young adult generation is not drinking in the same way that their parents and grandparents did in terms of its consumption habits. And that is a big problem every single day and week and month into the future when who is doing the buying changes. So the question is the Finger Lakes uniquely positioned to sort of withstand that and then deal with that because of a different size? It's much smaller, smaller volume of production, a little bit of different dynamics in play here. And some of the hope is that it is. But we're talking about what everyone can do better to reach people and make sure accessibility is happening. And Art Rogers is on the line with us. He is the chef and owner of the outstanding Lento in Rochester. Go ahead, Art.
Oh, hey, thanks for having me. I was just, this is a very interesting conversation, and I know the big trend with millennials in dining is skewing toward takeout and delivery. And when I was learning about cooking and wine, it was in a restaurant setting, and we worked on pairing wines with certain foods. And I'm wondering if, as more and more millennials stop going out and just stay in to be on their phones or be on their Netflix, that might be contributing to it, because it's much easier just to pick up a six-pack of beer or to have a bottle of vodka in your house to mix up a cocktail. And it's just sort of a different generational thing, possibly. I'm just wondering if your panel might have any insight on that.
It's a very fair question. Art, thank you. Bob Medill, I'll start with you. Do you see that? And Bob, by the way, is the wine director at the Outstanding Kindred Fair, so probably can have some thoughts on the same wavelength here.
I think it's a good point. I don't have any specific insight here, but I do agree that, because just from my own perspective, as often I just want to go home and have a glass of wine and cook my own meal and just take it easy. We get back into that whole issue of format. I, for one, I'm not worried about having a bottle or two of wine open in my fridge. Seems to do just fine. Of course, maybe it doesn't last as long in my house as it would in others. But what about you, August? I'm sort of...
Yeah, I mean, so I... This weekend, I was hanging out with some college friends, and we actually had this very conversation, and these were all millennials. And I guess if you consider me a millennial, I'm a border case. But we actually wound up staying home in part because we could open a couple bottles of wine, nobody had to drive, and we could order in food, and there was something to that. So I think that there is opportunities if we think about it in the right way. And if we manage to make it easy to open up a bottle of wine, if people are doing more takeout and eating more at home, I actually think on some level this is not a bad thing for the alcohol industry, whether that's wine, beer, whoever. I actually think that this is an opportunity. We just have to find a way.
It's bad for art.
Yes, it is. Yeah. It's bad for art. I'm sorry, art. But I think that at least for us who are selling wine, it's maybe an opportunity if we see it the right way.
Let me also say to Joe Roberts, who is a big data guy, I don't have any data in front of me that demonstrates whether Gen Z and millennials go out to eat less often. I suspect it's true, and I suspect it's complex. In other words, we're talking wages is a big part of this. You know, who's got disposable income? What are they going to do with that? What options do they have if they stay home? Maybe technology, as Art says, maybe that ties in. I don't have data in front of me, but Joe, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I would agree. I think that it's probably very complex. It wouldn't surprise me given kind of where we are in terms of generally with wage growth for younger consumers. And yeah, having said that, we do have data across the last few years that strongly suggest that younger consumers, you know, meaning now in their 30s to late 20s, are pretty much fearless when it comes to trying wine, for example. So anytime we've got a consumption habit change with a group like that, you do have an opportunity. I mean, you have an opportunity to get in there. I mean, anecdotally, I have seen incredible amounts of passion from people in that age group in terms of their interest in wine, going out of their way to get something that they consider very unique, willing to splurge on a bottle from time to time because of that, wanting to show their friends that they know something cool, new producer, new area, grape, what have you, that their friends don't maybe yet have exposure to, they can share with them. Those are all opportunities for reaching out. And in that, in the context of everything we've just discussed about that, none of that really is serviced by what you would consider, I think, the traditional methods of putting wine in front of consumers. So to your points, those changes are probably introducing quite a lot of opportunity. If we can just, as an industry, start to capitalize on it and not be afraid to take those chances in reaching out to a more diverse group or just connecting with them without a score, without a sort of traditional advertisers and glossy magazines or whatever it is.
Can I ask Art a question?
Oh, Art is not with us anymore. Okay. I mean, like, he's with us. He's just not on the line, right, as far as I know. In fact, if you go to Lento tonight, he'll be there.
Well, I'm just wondering, you know, but classically it was the Wine by the Glass program in a restaurant that helped small brands get ahead because we could afford to have a way of serving a customer a small amount of wine in relative terms and experiment. And I think that's still largely true, but now I'm questioning that.
Well, and when it comes to single glasses, we got to keep it tight. Boy, we could have done multiple hours on this. Sarah in Rochester wants to jump in. Go ahead, Sarah.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Cool. So I'm not a millennial, but one of the things that I've done, because I do enjoy wine, is in addition to a perfume subscription that I belong to, I signed up for Vinebox for a period of time. And that allows me to have a single serving, whatever type I feel like at the time, have that at dinner. I don't have to open an entire box. It broadens my experience with different wines. It's a surprise every time I get something. And it sits there, you know, on a counter in the kitchen. And whenever I feel like it, I don't have to go to a liquor store since we don't sell wine in the grocery stores here. It's certainly easier to pick up beer. I don't have to go to a special location. It's delivered right to my house, and I can experience whatever I'm in the mood for at the time. And it's been a great way to experience different wines and make it easily accessible to me.
Hmm. Sarah, thank you. Just another perspective on consumption.
Well, there's, to her point, in the Finger Lakes and I'm sure elsewhere, there's a great deal of interest on canning wine. And I know half a dozen producers in the Finger Lakes that are working on that. And in a different, entirely different model in the sense that the distributor behind the distribution of the canned wine is frequently a beer distributor. So it's connecting with a whole different way of behaving and treatment of wine.
I have to hit one point we haven't gotten to yet, which is that there is a question about the cannabis factor. We're seeing a lot more legalization happening, a discussion not only in different states. New York State appears to be moving in that direction with the governor's support. But the question becomes, is that going to impact the industry? And the report that we talked about at the top of the hour does reference this as perhaps having a limited impact on wine consumption habits. And we know that Constellation Brands is interested in getting in the game. Even Francis Ford Coppola recently announced would start their own Coppola cannabis brand. But Bob Mandel, briefly, you say that is not a concern to you in the Finger Lakes.
Not so much, Evan. I'm not saying there's going to be no impact. There's going to be an impact because it's another way of people spending money, disposable income, going to a recreational form of, you know, having relaxation. So that's going to have some impact.
Okay. And August, this isn't necessarily a zero-sum game. In other words, if people are going to consume cannabis legally, it doesn't mean they're going to consume less of other things?
Exactly, yeah. I just don't see it cutting into the market to the point where we in the Finger Lakes have to be concerned about it. I mean, if you own 30% of the wine market, you should probably be worried, but I don't think small producers, it's going to be a competition.
Joe Roberts, it was your piece on One Wine Dude and your website that helped kind of spark this interest in this discussion. Some final thoughts from you on what you want to see, to the extent that there is a monolithic wine industry, and some of your commenters on your website have pointed out, there's a lot of different companies and different personalities, but what do you want to see the industry do to make sure young adult consumers know and feel accessible and feel like they're going to put wine on the table?
I think, generally speaking, less inertia and less fear of being able to or wanting to try something different to reach out to those consumers. And that can be anything. It can be packaging. It can be marketing. I mean, we're dealing with the most competitive era in the history of this product of wine, and that history spans thousands of years. So that should really tell you something. I mean, anything that they can do to reach those consumers, stay competitive, would be a good thing. I mean, we've got an industry where you need a specialized tool just to open a normal bottle and consume it, right? There's a lot of inertia, hundreds of years, and we need to be less afraid to break that.
Okay, August Imel, 30 seconds. What's going to happen next to sort of deal with this issue?
Well, I think that I'm going to give a non-answer answer, which is I think everybody is going to throw at the wall what they're going to, but I think we're only going to succeed if we really take a hard look and come up with an answer that we probably haven't discussed today. I just don't know what that is.
Okay, Bob Mandel.
I see a lot more young people coming into the industry, Evan, men and women, young women all over the wineries, albeit and now in junior positions, assistant marketing, assistant winemaker. I think that's going to have an impact, which is going to be quite substantial over the next 3 to 5 years, and I'm looking forward to it.
All right. I want to thank our guests for taking the time to be here. And again, Joe Roberts writes One Wine Dude online. We'll link you to his piece if you want to check it out. And it's just kind of keeping an eye on the industry trends. And I will say this as a homer. This is not WXXI's opinion. This is mine, because I've done some writing. The Finger Lakes industry is so good and such a high level that I'm glad to hear that we're continuing having conversations about how to make sure more people can experience it, because it's really phenomenal. August Imel, continued congratulations. Great work at Cuca Spring Vineyards. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
You'll find Bob Mandel at Kindred Fair, among many other places. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Evan.
And Joe Roberts, I really appreciate the phone call. Come up here. I'll buy you a glass of wine.
Oh, yeah. Cheers. We're way overdue.
You got it. Joe Roberts joining us on the line, the writer of One Wine Dude. Rob Braden is the engineer of Connections, and Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a lovely afternoon. Talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.